wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are tuned to KVOO here in Portland, where the time is 9:02, and time for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
I'm Clayton Morgridge, your host for today's show, along with our engineer, Joe Clement. Well, here's what we have for you this morning. The Old Mole's Bill Resnick will be talking with Catherine Sammy, who teaches and writes on Iranian women and the struggle for a democratic Iran. They'll let you know how Iran is different from the image we get from the mainstream media. Then Jan Hocken will be here to talk with Amelia Bono, founding director of Shout Your Abortion, a movement dedicated to broadening the discourse surrounding abortion through art, media, and real-life events all over the country. They'll be talking about why Shout Your Abortion gathered such momentum in social media and how the stories in her co-authored book, Shout Your Abortion, speak to the political moment around reproductive justice. Our book mole, Larry Bolden, will review the novel Spill, Simmer, Falter, Wither by Sarah Baum. It's an endearing and insightful novel about two beings cast out of society, one a self-taught man with few social skills, the other a dog with even less social skills. Larry thinks that not since Iris Murdoch has a writer given an animal such a believable, moral, and rational voice. And I'll conclude the show with some timely thoughts about narcissism. If you're new to The Old Mole, you should know that the show is podcast, so you can hear it or any part of it again and recommend what you've heard to your friends. Just go to kboo.fm/oldmole or to iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Now, here is Bill Resnick with Catherine Sammy to talk about Iran.
Hi, Catherine Sammy. Welcome back to KBOO after all these years.
Thank you, Bill. It's nice to be back.
Catherine Sammy was a regular on the Old Mole maybe 20 years ago with her commentaries under the name of the Rebel Girl. Back then, she examined women's struggles, trying to bring working class and radical voices and perspectives. She became one of the founders and co-managers of, in other words, the Women's Book Tour. Today, she's teaching and writing at the University of California, Irvine, assistant professor of gender and sexuality studies in the School of Humanities. Catherine, you've visited Iran, have family in Iran, written a great deal on the Iranian women's movements and transnational feminism. For most people in this country, Iran is envisioned as a place where mobs of men surrounded the U.S. embassy, took the U.S. ambassador and mission hostage, and sort of Iran gets this, has this stereotype of Iran of sort of a Middle Eastern terrorist country, primitive, lawless, highly masculinist, violent. And the truth of it is so different of Iran today. So why don't you just give us your capsule story of Iran today?
Sure. Well, I think you actually have kind of captured it in a sense. I mean, one thing I would say right off, given what you how you sort of just introduced what the stereotype is although we're not formally at war with Iran, this kind of discursive or rhetorical war has been going on for decades and is violent in nature, so it you know sort of really overshadows the complexity of the country, which is a fascinating place. I mean, I have to say right off that I have not been there since 2009, which was 10 years ago, but it is a dynamic place. It's an interesting place. It's an ever-changing place. It's a complex place. Women are incredibly essential to the society and very present, and they have been, you know, for the last, you know, more than a century. But I would say, you know, the 40th anniversary of the Iranian Revolution was just this past February, and kind of reflecting on that, you know, it's important to acknowledge the kind of mixed record of the post-revolutionary state. It has done many things to improve the life circumstances of women, and you know, including you know, right after the revolution, many free universities were established all across the country. Now they're Islamic universities, but this enabled women who, under the Shah, under the kind of secular period, many sort of more traditional religious and conservative families didn't want their daughters to be in those spaces. And so many women became educated after the revolution in these Islamic universities. The fertility rates went down with women's education and with the massive government-sponsored population control campaign. Women became literate, women and men. You know, many poor and working class women and men learned to read and write. So many things have improved, including access to healthcare, access to education, to literacy. And, you know, this is a gain of the revolution. I think it's really important to understand this as something that the revolutionary and post-revolutionary government provided. Now, of course, it is and has been in the last 40 years under different kind of presidencies and parliaments, et cetera. And, you know, after the death of Khomeini and predecessor Khamenei, it's been very repressive against activists. So there's no question that there are problems and activists are targeted. And since 2009, after the fraudulent re-election of Ahmadinejad, the repression was quite intense. The crackdown on activists was really intense. So it is a complicated place, but of course it's a place where real people live and work and organize and go to universities, and families are changing. You know, women are very, very involved in daily life and have aspirations and ideas.
They're working now, right? A lot of women are out in public. It's not as if they're imprisoned in the home or in the neighborhood.
Absolutely.
Or in just in women's roles. Women are now everywhere in very important positions, it seems to me.
Absolutely. I mean, there's still, you know, prohibitions against, you know, for instance, women judges, but they are working. Now, the economy is awful, and of course sanctions have completely decimated the economy, so middle class working women, like everyone, these women are struggling in this economy. Inflation's incredibly high, the currency has been massively devalued, and sanctions really are killing people in a sense. You know, it's harder for people to get the kinds of health care and the filtered, you know, gasoline and et cetera, et cetera. But yes, women are not secluded in the home. This is a really kind of orientalist and racist stereotype about Iran and many parts of the Middle East. It's a thriving society, although it's suffering a lot because of, you know, the kind of political repression, but also because of this kind of global economy and global political moment. But yes, women are very present and are a huge part of the society and have, and activists in particular, and I should say, you know, I'm not sort of a general historian, but I really focus on activists. Women's rights activists have been, you know, mobilizing for decades, and really it's the kind of post-revolutionary period where you've seen a lot of very grassroots activism, everyday kinds of activism that has, in my mind, been really interesting. You know, not so much a kind of state feminism, although these activists have been in conversation with the state to overturn discriminatory laws, but really interesting and dynamic campaigns and movements. And in my mind, they have, these activists and, you know, sort of everyday women have shifted the sort of terms of the debate and have really changed people's kind of ideas about gender and about women's role in society. You know, like everywhere, we could say this sort of around the world, women are doing this in their societies all over the place, and Iran is no exception.
This is your OMO Variety Hour on KABU 90.7 FM. I'm Bill Resnick for The Mole, talking to Catherine Sammy today. Once 20 years ago, an Old Mole regular, now teaching and writing and working with students at the University of California, Irvine. We've been discussing contemporary Iran, one of the oldest civilizations, rich culture and language, full of organized groups and dissent, but also a religious establishment with power in the state that often clamps down very hard. Yet all sorts of opposition stays alive and contesting. Iran is such an interesting society. It's also, Catherine, a very, very, very old civilization. It seems to me sort of like one of the last surviving really old civilizations. Like, Iran's 10,000 years old. People living in place, constantly struggling and influencing another and creating a language and a culture. And it's my understanding is that Iranians are extremely sort of proud of being Persian, Iranian, however they see themselves.
That can cut different ways. I think it's important to recognize, you know, for some Iranians, particularly those, well, not particularly necessarily, but some in the diaspora who are more associated with the secular era of the Shah and who fled the revolution and weren't really supportive of the revolution, there can be a way of kind of articulating Persianness as a kind of way of distancing themselves from Islam, from the, you know, Islamic government, from the revolution, and that I'm not on board with. But you're right that it's, of course, it's a very old culture and old civilization, and I would say it's a proud people. It's a, you know, proud people who overthrew the monarchy in 1979 and were part of that effervescent moment. And yes, Iran has a very long and distinguished history of course, poetry. Rumi, Hafez, Sa'di, people learn poetry, children learn poetry, and it's not uncommon for people to recite poetry in the home. And so, yes, I would say it is important to kind of recognize its histories and its traditions and also its contributions to the world. When people talk about astronomers and philosophers and poets and thinkers. So I think that's important, but I don't want to do that, and I'm not on board with kind of doing that to think about, oh, everything, you know, was wonderful before the Arab invasion and Islam. You know, I'm not in favor of that discourse, obviously. But it is, you know, I think to kind of think about the complexity of the place and its long traditions and its many contradictions and nuances is really important. We just want to think about that in ways that don't kind of reinforce this idea that Islam and the kind of Islamic government is the source of everything horrible in Iran. So.
Yes, you know, but it seems to me I brought that up not so much to. It's all very interesting. I had no idea about some of the ways in which the Persian culture and values were being grasped by the left somehow to distinguish themselves from the Islamics. And I can see that. I'm sure that happens. But I brought it up because there really is a powerful sort of nationalism, and especially in the all over the Arab world, having been colonized and treated as sort of inferior civilizations, as
absolutely
as have blacks and so many peoples, Native Americans in the United States, a tremendous lack of appreciation for the richness of the cultures and the way they operated.
Absolutely.
And the way they were ruined, actually, by the invention of gunpowder and guns and the capacity to overrun societies and take them over by imperialism and the long history. Not ruined, but...
Yeah, well, I think Iran, I mean, it's important just for listeners, you know, Iran was never formally colonized, but it is a kind of, it's, you know, Iranians are colonial subjects in that there's a long history of British control of the oil industry. Obviously, the coup in 1953 was a response to Mossadegh, you know, nationalizing the oil industry. And so in that sense, there have been, you know, many, 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 many decades of kind of foreign meddling and you know, American soft power, and now, you know, the recent period is a kind of continuation of a very colonialist and neocolonialist and, you know, racist control and sort of management of a nation that has aspired to and had a revolution that was about many things, but one thing in particular about sort of throwing off that colonial intervention and that imperialist, you know, sort of framing. And so that's really important. I'm really interested in the ways in which in the post-revolutionary period, in my mind, that, you know, many women and others, you know, who sort of also were sidelined in some ways, their interests were sidelined by the revolution. And this is true of revolutions everywhere. You know, the promise of the revolution is that it's going to liberate everyone. And, you know, the kind of anti-colonial aspirations or that, you know, this is going to be wonderful for women and for women's equality. And then, you know, what always ends up happening is that those in power, you know, often sideline women's issues and other sort of minority issues. In my mind, the kind of post-revolutionary period, there is an anti-colonial thrust to that and a nationalist thrust in the kind of current, you know, striving for democratization of the society. But it's different than 1979. It's the women that I interviewed who were really active on the 1 million signatures campaign really talked about, you know, a kind of, and many scholars have talked about this, a kind of more pragmatic approach to social change, a kind of, you know, more long haul, not necessarily anti-revolutionary kind of approach, but not thinking in these kind of grander gestures, but really kind of looking at how do we engage with the state around its kind of through its own discourses about its promises, you know, the kind of post-revolutionary state, but revolutionary state's promises to deliver equality, and how can we sort of expose where the state has been contradictory, has not delivered on certain questions of women's equality, mostly legal, sort of legal equality. So I'm really interested in kind of thinking about how have feminists kind of reframed or reimagined this nationalist kind of sentiment from a feminist perspective that doesn't sacrifice women's equality and women's autonomy for this nationalist project. And that, to me, has been a really striking and interesting thing about the kind of last, you know, several decades in Iran, to reimagine a kind of anti-colonial, anti-military, pro-democratic aspiration country and movement that doesn't sacrifice, you know, women, that doesn't trade away women's equality in, you know, for independence and for sovereignty.
Catherine, it's really been good talking to you today. This was part one of our interview. We'll do the second part and much more on the women's movement coming up. So let's just say goodbye for this piece, and then we'll continue.
Thanks so much, Bill. It's been great being on the Old Mole again, and we'll talk again soon.
And that was Iranian-American Mamek Kadem singing Invocation. And before that, we heard Catherine Sammy talking with the Old Mole's Bill Resnick about Iran. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Next up, the Old Mole's Jan Hocken is on the line with Amelia Bono to discuss her work on the film and project Shout Your Abortion. Jan.
Amelia Bono, welcome to KBOO.
Hi, Jan. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. Well, Clayton Morgridge, our host, talked about your film, but that hopefully will be down the road. For now, it's a book, and a fabulous book indeed, that follows on the viral hashtag Shout Your Abortion that took off in 2015 and became a kind of a mantra of the reproductive rights movement and part of a larger campaign to normalize abortion. First, tell us about that phrase and what captured the imagination, the aspirations of feminists that led to the viral success of it beginning in 2015.
Yeah, so, you know, I think that my co-founder, Lindy West, who's an incredible feminist author, I feel like she spoke to that answer most succinctly a while back when she said, shouting is simply the opposite of a whisper. And we've long been taught that our abortions are not to be discussed. You know, that they're sort of shameful secrets that we carry with us. We maybe whisper about them to our closest friends or relatives, but for the most part, personal abortion stories have not been a part of public discourse about abortion rights. And I think that that's a huge reason why the policy that we're seeing enacted today doesn't actually reflect people's real needs or values or lives, because our personal stories are missing. So in 2015, I had had an abortion in 2014, and it may shock some listeners to hear me say this, but it was a really empowering and positive experience. I, of course, would have preferred to have not become pregnant, but when I found myself pregnant, I knew that I was going to be able to take care of it. I knew that the folks at Planned Parenthood were going to take incredible care of me, as they always had, and that there was a clinic just a few blocks away where I could afford an abortion, where I would receive really high quality care, where I wouldn't experience any barriers to my access. And I truly just didn't feel convoluted or bad about having to do this. I just felt really lucky and really grateful that I was in a position where it was being made easy and shameless for me. Because also, I live in Seattle, Washington, which, you know, is like one of the most liberal and secular parts of the country. And so really, the folks in my life are pro-choice. And I just sort of knew that it wasn't going to have to be something that I carried with me like this horrible, shameful secret, and that I could, in fact, have as much support from the people around me as I wanted. So fast forward about a year later, it was when the video attacks were coming out against Planned Parenthood, framing the organization as, you know, a baby brain chop shop or whatever, just this ludicrous propaganda, which has been subsequently absolutely thrown out as the trash that it is. But it was incredibly damaging at this time, and it was the first time that Republicans had mounted this effort to defund Planned Parenthood. And so the day that Planned Parenthood was defunded by the House of Representatives, I wrote a status update on Facebook saying, you know what, I had an abortion about a year ago at Planned Parenthood, and I'm not sorry, I'm not ashamed, and I'm actually just really grateful to have had this experience and for the care that I received. And I'm telling you this today because I think that the anti-choice movement is relying on silence from pro-choice women who have had abortions. And I hit post, I sent a screenshot to my friend Lindy, who I mentioned earlier. Lindy put that screenshot on Twitter and added the hashtag #ShoutYourAbortion. And within a couple of days, the hashtag had been used about 250,000 times by people all over the world talking about their own abortion experiences.
So part of your project is not only shouting in response to the anti-abortion, anti-choice forces, but within the pro-choice movement, within the larger feminist movement, there's also been an element of, if not shame, a certain veiled protectiveness. Some of the protectiveness of abortion care comes out of assaults on it and violence, but it also, I think you're saying there's some internalized discomfort or anxiety, feeling that you're rejecting a central aspect of femininity around maternality if you choose not to carry a pregnancy, and that this perpetuates a certain dynamic that doesn't serve us well. It seems like you're tapping into that, not only the antis, but a dynamic within the women's movement, within feminism, within the pro-choice movement itself.
Yeah, I think that that's absolutely true. I think that Shout Your Abortion is really just the idea that we're allowed to talk about our own lives and our own abortions however we choose to talk about them. And in many ways, like, it's as much of a response to the anti-choice movement's efforts to terrorize us into silence as it is to the pro-choice movement's efforts to capitulate and create a sort of apologistic stance around abortion, and this idea that, like, if we don't really talk about it, we can just kind of sneak it in there. And, you know, of course, Safe, Legal, and Rare, which thankfully has, like, fallen by the wayside at this point, but, you know, I can't think of any less compelling way to argue for something than by essentially saying, yeah, we agree that this thing is kind of bad, but sometimes we need it, so we're sorry, but please let us have it.
So there is that seeking redemption through a compelling story. And can you speak to that issue now, or that dynamic, as these laws are passed that become increasingly horrifying and restrictive, falling heavily on poor and marginalized communities,
right.
and that the pro-choice movement is sometimes reviving the tragic stories of the past in summoning support. How many incest survivors or rape survivors are now will be forced to carry pregnancies? How do you respond to that in terms of the call for a redemptive accounts or stories to justify abortion?
You know, I think that it's a really deliberate tactic of the anti-choice movement to write bills like the ones that we're seeing in Alabama that are so extreme that they don't have exceptions for rape or incest. And then we're hearing these tales trotted out of 11-year-old rape victim forced to carry a child. And then the pro-choice movement is like responding by elevating those stories and showing them as if to say, like, this is so messed up, you guys. How can you possibly be doing this? But, you know, anyone who is denied an abortion, anyone who is forced to procreate, has lost their right to life and has been disenfranchised in the most total and abhorrent way possible. This is not a gradient where some abortion bans are really extreme and some are not. Like, being forcing people to bear children is as extreme as it gets. And I think that the anti-choice movement knows that if they put stuff out there that's just so horrific, that we will attempt to use those horrific stories as an appeal, which then sort of implicitly suggests that it's not that extreme to ban abortion at 20 weeks. So then their next legislative move will seem sort of tempered in comparison.
Yeah, let's meet somewhere in the middle kind of idea, across the aisle.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think part of what is so easily forgotten in movements is the history of past struggles and what was at stake. Before Roe v. Wade, in many places in the country, women could secure a therapeutic abortion by going before a panel of doctors in a hospital and saying, you know, if I carry this pregnancy, I'm forced to, I'll kill myself or my child, or I'll go crazy. And so the liberatory side of legalizing abortion was not having to get permission from the medical profession to say, this is something I've decided for whatever reason. And yet Roe v. Wade never fulfilled that promise, because it's still very much tied to whether you can find a provider to secure the services. And for many women in the country, it's out of reach. Other places, like in Seattle, it's not difficult. How do you, in this book, which, by the way, is a fabulous read and it's beautifully produced, some might see the topic as not lending itself to a high aesthetic, but it certainly is like the website itself. It's a fulfilling read. It's interesting. It's funny, sad. I mean, you've gathered up a lot of threads of women's lives as well as the abortion issue through these stories. How do you think about, in the production of this book, the role of storytelling and the diversity of stories and the class and race politic in the fight for reproductive justice, even as you create a unifying refusal to apologize?
So I think that that's a great question. So just to backtrack a little bit, so Shout Your Abortion took off as this viral hashtag in 2015, and pretty much immediately it was much more than that. It was like this grassroots movement where people all over the country started having events and making art and doing graffiti and making clothes and having abortion speak outs and just doing all of these small community things that were like actions geared towards forcing their community to figure out how to hold space for these stories. And so then I had been in graduate school at the time. I left school. I was able to secure a grant to make this thing into a full-fledged, fully legit organization. And we're now in our fourth year as a nonprofit, essentially. And so the book is really like the first super concrete attempt at a snapshot of what is a very vast and freeform and pluralistic movement. Because we're not like telling people how to talk about abortion. We're just giving them tools that will help them do so and supporting them as they're undertaking these projects in whatever ways we can. But while knowing that like the way that people want to talk about abortion in the Bronx is very different than Montgomery, Alabama, than Seattle, and you can say that a million times over, even within just same city, a community in the same city. So the book was a bit like intimidating because the idea of putting parameters around something that's so open felt sort of antithetical to the whole thing. But at the same time, we really wanted to create a resource that could travel far and that we could get into abortion clinics so that people would be seeing this material right before or right after they have an abortion of their own. And we've subsequently done that. It's in 250 abortion clinics in the waiting and recovery rooms and counting.
I can confirm that claim because filming in abortion clinics in different parts of the country, including Portland and Seattle, we saw your materials. It's an interesting intervention at a point where many women are vulnerable to the shaming that is not an inevitable effect of the abortion, but the social context that produces the shaming.
Absolutely.
So that was quite an intervention.
Right, and that's how I see it too, is like a stigma intervention. I think a lot of people just truly have no idea that there is any alternative to silence and shame and self-hatred. And so just letting them know, there are people out there, there is a global community that of people who love themselves, who are proud of who they are, who have had abortions, and who are living good lives. And you don't have to hate yourself for what you're doing today. To quickly go back to your other question, because I think it's really important about like the diversity of subjects in the book, that was the most important thing for us, was to include as many kinds of stories from different kinds of people from all over the country as possible in order to truly show just the vastness of this experience. Obviously, it would be incredibly like shallow and, you know, harmful if the book was just full of like young middle-class white women like me who had no problems accessing the procedure and felt totally fine about it. So we started with geographical diversity because that's, I think, the biggest big piece that determines the nature of a person's experience, is their ability to access the service easily and the social context in which that's happening. So we sent a photographer to like 9 different states. Some were southern, some were coastal, some were in the Midwest. And we contacted subjects and found these stories and stuff. But the stories range, like, there are 43 stories. Subjects range in age from 17 to 85. There are people of faith and sex workers and people all over the gender spectrum, people all over the race spectrum, people who are poor, people who are wealthy, people who are famous, people who, you know, there's just all sorts of different folks in there. And I think that in aggregate, it does begin to represent. Oh, and also there are people who have had multiple abortions, which is something that's still, I think,
highly stigmatized
within the pro-choice movement. There's a woman who's had 5 abortions. There's another who's had 4.
And you also gather up a range of feelings of sadness and loss, as well as joy and liberatory sentiments. Well, Amelia, in closing, can you just say a bit about how our listeners can find the book and also learn more about Shout Your Abortion, the organization, which is, I think, a wonderful part of a larger movement more than ever in need of our support and our participation.
Yeah.
So how can listeners find out more?
The book is for sale on our website and as well as many other places online, but the best place to start is our website, shoutyourabortion.com. It's a place where a person can add their own abortion story in text or video, and there are hundreds if not thousands of stories on the site, as well as all sorts of documentation of different projects that people have done all over the country, and it really gives you a good feel for what this movement is. You can follow us on social media at Shout Your Abortion, and those are the really easiest ways. You can also just Google Shout Your Abortion book, and it will probably be, you can buy it all sorts of places.
Okay,
that way.
You're not hard to find. So,
not hard to find.
This is Jan Hocken talking today with Amelia Bono, co-editor along with Emily Noak of Shout Your Abortion, now available as a fabulous book. It's a satisfying and engaging read, along with the website and your social media. Thanks so much for being with us today, Amelia.
Thank you, Jen.
It's my book.
and that It's My Body by Rachel Coleman, following up on the conversation between Amelia Bono and Jan Hocken about the book and the movement Shout Your Abortion. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO. I'm Clayton Morgridge. We turn now to our book mole, Larry Bolden, who has what sounds like an unusual novel to tell us about. Larry.
Good morning. I want to talk to you this morning about an incredibly lovely book by Sarah Baum entitled Spill, Simmer, Falter, Wither. Quoting from an early passage in the book, he is running, 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 and it's like no kind of running he's ever done before. He's the surge that burst the dam, and he's pouring down the hill slope. This time there's no chance to sniff and scavenge and scoff. There are no steel bars to end his lap, no chain to jerk at the limit of its extension, no bellowing to trick and bully him back. This time he's further than he's ever seen before, past every marker along the horizon line, every hump and spork he learned by heart. He is running, 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 and there's no course or current to deter him. He is one eye now. He is on his way. Close quote. Lucky for the dog, One Eye, that he is adopted by a man as lonely and abandoned as he is, selected from a bunch of creatures, mistreated, abandoned, abused. When the kennel keeper grabs him by the scruff and leads him to the man says to the dog, "You are leaning low, nearly dragging your body along the ground, as though carrying a great lump of fear." Close quote. The dog is a terrier, and although the reader never discovers just where he came from or how he was abused, it is suggested that he went down a hole after a badger, losing his eye in the ensuing battle. The man is living in his father's house and has no memory of a mother. His father is dead, but the son remains in the house, which he says is as close to a mother as he's ever known. He is 57, too old to start over and too young to give up. The village in which he lives sees him as ugly and retarded, and his father keeps him away from school and pretty much away from all of society, more or less embarrassed by his awkward, ugly son. But the man and dog carve out a life, and very soon the man cannot imagine life without One Eye. He watches the dog, amazed by his nose, amazed that he can be hypnotized by smell. Quote, "I wish I'd been born with your capacity for wonder." Close quote. The story of their interdependence is a sad but lovely one. We learn that as a boy, with almost no help from his father, the man learned to read. And then, when in his 40s, because his father is too crippled with gout to drive, he teaches the man how to drive. While he's frightened by most people, he loves to read. Despite the villager's misconception, he is not retarded. This is a debut novel for Sarah Baum, and she finds ingenious ways to have the dog's voice heard by the readers. He talks to the dog and then tells us how the dog responds. He reads to the dog and listens carefully for One Eye's commentary. Turns out that One Eye has a moral take on the world as well as a rational one. Like Iris Murdoch, the famous philosopher novelist, Baum allows the dog to speak, and the reader learns so much from the interchange between dog and man. Unfortunately, just as many in the village see the man as menacing, they come to see the dog as a menace as well. Not entirely undeserved, since the dog viciously latches on to two other dogs at separate times, one small and terrified by the jaws of the terrier, and the other a handsome collie owned by a rich woman who is bitten on the snout by One Eye. Knowing that animal control will soon come to his house and take the dog away, and unable to imagine going back to his utterly lonely life prior to One Eye, the two take off and travel the back roads and small villages of Ireland, living in the car or beside it, and surviving as they can from day to day and town to town. Shortly before deciding that they need to run, the man takes stock of his perhaps rash decision to adopt the dog. Again quoting, "I should never have adopted you. You bring trouble, then just when I think the trouble has passed, you bring trouble again. Caring for you is like keeping a nettle in a pretty porcelain flower pot, watering its roots and pruning its vicious needles, no matter how cruelly it stings my skin, until I'm pink and puffy all over, yet still worrying the old welts back to life. And now I think how I was my father's nettle. his big lump of an embarrassing son, a son fit only to be kept indoors, away from people and from light, where there's nothing to sting but himself. End quote. I notice that most of what I've described seems too sad, but in fact there is much joy and loveliness in this insightful little novel. Again, the man speaking to the dog, I wonder how we have grown to resemble one another, as we're supposed to. On the outside, we're still as black and gnarled as nature made us, but on the inside, I feel different somehow. I feel animalized. Now there's wildness inside me that kicked off with you. Unquote. Man rescues dog, and dog rescues man. This is a wonderful love story, and one that you'll be glad you read. I've been talking about Sarah Baum's novel, Spill, Simmer, Falter, Wither. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
A little bit of Coraline's Welcome, following up on Larry Bolden's review of Sarah Baum's novel Spill, Simmer, Falter, Wither. Here on the Old Mole Variety Hour, I'm Clayton Morgridge, and I'd like to tell you why I think capitalism is organized narcissism. An important task for a socialist writer is to make capitalism look as bad as it really is. This is essential to the socialist project, because capitalism has so many ways of making itself look good in the propaganda it distributes through the corporate media, advertising, and the education system which it dominates. Daily we are shown the glossy and benign face of capital as providing all good things, from jobs to all our enticing consumer goods. So it takes a lot of effort to show the system in its true colors. Yet the underlying and terrible truth about capitalism is not hard to see if one just burrows a little way below the surface. Among the many charges we can bring against capitalism is that it is a system of organized crime. It organizes the predatory activity of wealthy families and corporations and protects them from real and potential uprisings of the people they exploit. Capitalism is also, like much crime, psychopathic. In particular, it is organized narcissism. Here's a description of the psychopath by forensic psychologist Barbara Kerwin. Most psychopaths could pass as normal people. They hold down jobs, they have relationships, though often superficial ones, and they manage to manage, however selfishly. But more than most people, they are selfish, highly absorbed with securing the primitive comforts of life. They cannot delay their gratification or set aside their resentments. They are usually charming, eager to please, and quite often very smart. However, though they may function in the world effectively, they do not conduct their lives according to accepted moral codes and standards of behavior. They do not consider their crimes crimes. What seems a crime to us is to them an expedience, an act of entitlement. As intelligent as they may be, psychopaths lack an awareness that they are participating in the overall drama of the human species. Accused of a crime, they believe that the world that owes them a living has done them wrong. End of quote. According to Kerwin, psychopathy is not a mental disease or defect, but a global attitude of selfishness that governs a person's interactions with others. More than just selfish, psychopaths are narcissistic. Narcissism makes people dangerous because it deprives them of the restraint that results from empathy and respect for others. Narcissism permits them to ignore the humanity of their victims. It renders them insensitive to the act of killing. The blindness of the narcissist can extend even beyond the lack of empathy. Narcissists may not see others at all. The notorious Ted Bundy was a psychopath, according to Kerwin, who interviewed him at length. Bundy raped and mutilated at least 30 women, felt no remorse, regretted only that he'd been caught, and bragged that he owned a girl like he owned a Porsche. But the narcissism of capital is not the result of narcissistic individuals, contrary to the capitalist propaganda that everything is down to the individual. The capitalist is not usually a narcissist by birth, who then inherits or gains control of a big capitalist operation. To be a capitalist is first and foremost to have a certain role with certain powers and responsibilities, and living in this role leads one to be a narcissist, both in action and in one's heart. The capitalist system, then, is narcissistic in two senses. First, its operations are aimed only at its limited growth, and it cares nothing for any other values. Individual capitalists sometimes have other interests, but qua capitalist, their job is to put growth ahead of everything else. Secondly, capitalism is narcissistic in that it produces narcissists, for it is far easier to exploit people and the earth if one has no human feelings for them. The obligation to maximize the bottom line swamps all other concerns. Examples of capitalist narcissism are not hard to find. The benefits of our corporate health insurance and long-term care insurance are sometimes hard to claim because the insurance companies would always rather delay than pay, especially if the claimants are likely to die before the benefits kick in. We now know how opioid manufacturers lied about the dangers of their drugs and made millions as millions died. ExxonMobil knew in the 1980s that burning carbon-based fuel was going to lead to climate catastrophe, but continued to pump, refine, and market it. Like Ted Bundy, they are unable to see or care about the harm they do. But for the corporation and the corporate executive, it's not because of something wrong with them psychologically, but because of this basic fact about capitalism. What gets done, what one must do in a capitalist society as a capitalist, is what profits the investor, and what does not profit the investor is not done. Of course, there are some accommodations capital must make with the public interest, but these are mostly window dressing, like the warning labels on cigarette packages. To the extent that we play this game and allow our social relations with others to be stripped down to the cash nexus and the quid pro quo, we live as narcissists among narcissists. It's a cold world, this world of organized crime, the world of the film noir, in which only the love interest provides a momentary respite from the Hobbesian state of war of all against all. But most people are not narcissists at heart. They do understand and respond to the experiences and situations of other people, even people who are far away. The ties between us are deeper than the cash nexus and the rule of law. We are bound by ties of affection based on empathy for the situations of other people. For the situations of other people are exactly what cannot be felt by the psychopathic narcissist. The enthusiastic capitalist, in pursuit of the profit margin, may love and empathize with members of his family and circle of friends, but to have these feelings towards those with whom he exchanges money and commodities is ruled out by the structure of his work. If such feelings arise, they must be squelched. A fully civilized society, free of the incubus of private property, will be one in which ties of affection will extend freely to everyone we meet and to all those whose experiences we come to know about. Only then can we be cured of the social pathology of capitalistic narcissism. I'm Clayton Morgeridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour. We'll be right back. wraps up the Old Mole for today. Many thanks to Catherine Sammy and Bill Resnick for their discussion of Iran, to Amelia Bono and Jan Hocken for letting us know about the book and the movement, Shout Your Abortion, and to Larry Bolden for his review of Sarah Baum's novel, Spill, Simmer, Falter, Wither. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Our engineer today is the Old Mole's Joe Clement. Join us again next week for more news, views, reviews, and interviews from the Mole's underground perspective.